We're going to go, wow. And for those of you who think the rule against perpetuities would never enter your life again, see? All right. 07-1160, United States versus Van Allen. Mr. Nichol?
Yes, Your Honor.
Hello.
Andy Nichol on behalf of the appellant, Melvin Van Allen, Jr. Your Honor, this is a direct appeal by Mr. Van Allen of his conviction on 4 counts of bankruptcy fraud and 28 counts of structuring currency transactions. Mr. Van Allen has identified 5 grounds for overruling his conviction. In his first argument, we asked this court today to hold that a person cannot be convicted of structuring a transaction without evidence that a transaction was structured.
Well, that's not really a fair way of putting it. Your argument seems to take a very narrow view of what structuring can be, and it seems to postulate that there has to be a moment in time that some large chunk of money is in a person's possession, and then that person then breaks it down to smaller amounts of money. But it seems to me on these facts there is a great deal of evidence that might have persuaded a jury that Mr. Van Allen, working with the companies that he was doing business with, took care, you know, the checks would be written for $9,500 and then a different check for $1,200, and he churned a phenomenal amount of money through this account he had at the Archer Bank.
Respectfully, Your Honor, the evidence of asking his customers to split checks relates to counts number 30 through 32. The challenge on this point is to counts number 5 through 29.
Well, would you concede that for the currency exchanging, for the currency exchange structuring counts, the 30 to 32,
Your Honor,
where no CTRs were filed, that the evidence that the bank filed CTRs would be irrelevant to those counts?
Now, that's our second issue, is whether the filing of CTRs was excluded. And, Your Honor...
Yeah, but if I don't ask you now, I'll forget.
As to that issue, the government presented its case that Mr. Van Allen had this large scheme to evade the reporting requirements.
But surely he must have. I mean, this evidence of the amount of money he was willing to pay at currency exchanges. This is a man with 3 bank accounts. People in their right minds don't go to currency exchanges and pay $94,982 in fees just for the fun of it if you have a bank account.
Respectfully, Your Honor, the government did not present any evidence that the amount of fees Mr. Van Allen paid was exorbitant.
Well, but what it did present was evidence of the amount of the fees. These are all circumstantial pieces of evidence where he is going to some trouble to convert checks that he receives into cash as opposed to simply depositing the checks in the bank account and waiting a couple of days for them to clear.
Yes, Your Honor.
And for free.
The evidence at trial was that Mr. Van Allen could not wait for the checks to clear.
Well, that's his story at trial. But a jury could have thought that if he could have just reset the clock by 3 business days, none of this would have happened.
And while that may be evidence of Mr. Van Allen's intent,
sure,
I don't believe that that makes the filing of the CTRs irrelevant. And it also doesn't provide evidence that Mr. Van Allen actually engaged in acts of structuring.
Well, couldn't a jury infer from his conduct, for example, at B&B Automotive, where, you know, he's directing the customer on a number of occasions, I don't know, 4, something like that, to write multiple checks on a single day, each check to be under $10,000, but the aggregate of the checks exceed $10,000. I mean, couldn't a jury infer from his conduct that he was engaged in similar conduct on other days with other customers or vendors?
Your Honor, I think that would be an improper propensity inference. The government has the burden.
Propensity if he actually submitted these thousands of different cash deposits that all just happened to be all but three of them. All the government argues all but three of 1,148 cash deposits were in amounts under $10,000.
Yes, Your Honor, but we believe under Davenport the government has to prove that Mr. Van Allen altered a transaction. And in the case of Davenport, this court explained that the transaction that was altered in Davenport was the receipt and the deposit in an amount over $100,000.
Sure, and that was the situation in Davenport. But why can't the government show from a pattern of behavior 1,148 cash deposits all under $10,000, even though on a daily basis the amounts exceeded that? Why wouldn't that allow a jury to infer that this is a different way of structuring?
Because, Your Honor, for each count, the government had the burden to show that Mr. Van Allen engaged in acts of structuring. If the jury were to infer from his conduct on the three or four counts in which his transactions with the currency exchanges were at issue, if the jury was to infer that his transactions with Archer Bank also involved structuring, it would reverse the burden. Mr. Van Allen would have to prove that he did not structure.
The government picked these 25 different days for the structuring counts. Each one of those days, he deposited more than $10,000 in multiple tranches, if you will. So it shows particular days, and it showed that these deposits were made as they were.
But if these deposits were the result of Mr. Van Allen and his sons individually selling goods to different customers, and that the proceeds were never held at one time, there would be no transaction to be structured.
Well, that was his story, of course, but the jury could have simply not believed that it was just an unfortunate set of circumstances on any given day.
But the jury would have no basis to distinguish between legitimate deposits and the proceeds or the result of illegal structuring.
I don't know why that's the case. I mean, you say that, and I understand what you're saying, but I don't know why the jury couldn't see from this behavior, why it wouldn't be legitimate for the jury to say, no, this actually was no accident. The reason you're even operating in cash is to make sure that you stay below the $10,000 threshold.
I believe the evidence at trial showed that Mr. Van Allen was operating in cash because his suppliers required him to pay in cash.
But his suppliers weren't paying him in cash. That's what I mean. It's the other half of the transaction where the bank didn't say, we accept only cash deposits. The suppliers didn't say, we refuse to pay you.
No, Your Honor. And if Mr. Van Allen truly indeed wanted to avoid the CTR filing requirements, he should have just deposited the checks into the bank accounts, because a deposit of a check does not trigger the filing requirement in any amount. So the fact that Mr. Van Allen didn't just merely deposit the check shows that his intent was to do something. He had another purpose other than evading the structuring requirements, and that purpose was he needed cash in the account to cover checks that were drawn on the account.
Again, I mean, I think I can certainly see you making that argument to a jury, but when you take all of the government's evidence as a whole, the fact that, of course, functioning in cash, as the introduction of the 2003 tax return illustrated, let's say facilitated keeping this information all off of his tax returns, also facilitated his, on another count that we have before us here, the bankruptcy fraud count, facilitated that. A jury is entitled to look at the full picture, right?
Your Honor, the jury is entitled to look at the full picture, but we believe that the government had the burden to show that a transaction was structured, and that the propensity and the inference is just that because more than $10,000 was deposited, that it must have been the result of structuring, we believe is improper and would be manifest injustice to uphold a conviction on that evidence alone. Turning to the bankruptcy fraud count, in count three, the government convicted Mr. Van Allen of concealing his business.
The reason for that, I suppose, is that he valued his business at $150,000 when he was applying for a mortgage. So why wasn't he obliged to report the value, that sole proprietorship, when he filed for bankruptcy? It didn't matter, it seems to me, whether it had a separate corporate form. The value had to appear somewhere in, you know, on the schedules.
And, Your Honor, the value did appear on the schedules. Under Illinois law,
where
in the form of the Archer account and his trucks, those were the assets used in Mr. Van Allen's business operation. Those
but
were the
no,
only.
Look, I mean that claims that he has a right to net out receipts and disbursements, and there's nothing on this form that gives him that right. In fact, to the contrary, you're supposed to report income. Suppose on my income tax return I decided, well, I have a certain amount of money that I pay for my mortgage every month, and I pay, you know, something to send my children to school, and so I'm just going to report on the income line the net that I have left over. Sure, you can't say that that would be a legitimate report.
And, Your Honor, if the government had charged and convicted Mr. Van Allen with swearing a false oath, that might be at issue, but they charged and convicted Mr. Van Allen of concealing non-existent property.
Well, but no. He was churning huge amounts of money through this. He never tells them how much income is coming in. I'm looking at the bankruptcy forms right now.
And the government never showed that there was any income coming from the business. The FBI testified that it couldn't quantify Mr. Van Allen's expenses.
They knew his receipts. Income.
Oh, I'm sorry, the net income.
Gross income. It's not asking about net income, though. It's just asking about income.
But Your Honor, they didn't charge him with concealing the cash. In fact, the cash was deposited into the Archer account, which
on
was
the
disclosed.
Form, he conceals it. He doesn't say anything about it. And on SA 168, we have this definition section, definition of in business, a debtor's in business if, among other things, he's a sole proprietor or self-employed.
Yes, Your Honor. He likely was required to report it there, but that does not mean he concealed an asset in the form of an unincorporated business.
He conceals the fact that he's getting money under whatever capacity, under, you know, his name, Mr. Van Allen, or as a sole proprietor. You can't mean that sole proprietors don't need to fill in the income line on these forms.
No, Your Honor.
Because their money comes in under their capacity as a sole proprietor.
Look, if he had reported the millions of dollars, we're talking about millions of dollars of transactions that went on, the gross income, the expenses, something, he'd have, I mean, you might have an argument, but he didn't report any of it, either as an individual or as
And the government didn't charge or convict Mr. Van Allen of failing to disclose the receipts or of failing to disclose his expenses.
No, they said it was a fraudulent form, and the thing that made it fraudulent is it didn't have this information on it.
Respectfully, Your Honor, they convicted Mr. Van Allen of concealing property in the form of an unincorporated business.
Right, and there's not a hint of this business on the form.
But, Your Honor, under Illinois law, a sole proprietorship is not.
But Illinois law is not what governs this. The bankruptcy laws govern this, and the federal bankruptcy form, regardless of what Illinois or any other state says, indicates that sole proprietorships count.
Yes, Your Honor, in his duty to disclose, which would be relevant.
And
if
they count as part of his business.
You're totally out of time.
Well, we've been asking you so many questions, we're going to give you time for rebuttal.
I appreciate that,
Only
Your
if
Honor.
You want to come back.
Yeah. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Don't volunteer.
Okay, Mr. Haiti, come on up. We have questions for you, too. So we have a few transactions where there's evidence that Mr. Van Allen asked that multiple checks be written in certain amounts, all under $10,000, when the total would have been over $10,000, you know, if payment had been made in one check. But for all the other transactions, what does the government have besides evidence that he simply made a lot of deposits and a lot of withdrawals? You wonder, how does a small business that deals in large amount of cash avoid prosecution? Do they have to wait until they have $10,000 before dashing, you know, over to the bank to make a deposit? We were talking about, you know, this case in Chambers, and one of us noted that they were that there was a gas station in their neighborhood when many years ago. The gas station is located next to a bank, and it took in a lot of cash throughout the day, and a smart business owner, you know, was running over to the bank all the time to reduce the risk of robbery. And so, in other words, what I'm trying to say is that frequent deposits in the aggregate that exceed the reporting limits are not by themselves enough to show an intent to evade. So is it the high fees? Is that it, that he was willing to pay, that you think, you know?
First of all, Judge Rohner, good morning.
Good morning.
Judge
Bauer, no.
Judge Ward.
Oh, I'm so
May please the court. Deposits in the aggregate is not enough, and we didn't bring a case based on just the deposits in the aggregate. Your Honor, there was a wealth of evidence that was offered which showed that this defendant was structuring, and I would echo Judge Wood's comments that not only was there a great deal of evidence of structuring, but the evidence could not have been any clearer as to what this defendant's intent was. It couldn't have been any clearer unless he gave a confession. This was a man who did everything he could to keep his business off the radar screen. His own bankruptcy attorney testified about how he lied to her about the business. It is a fact that he failed to disclose any business income or expenses during the bankruptcy proceeding. He signed a false bankruptcy petition. It is a fact that he failed to report any business income or expenses to the Internal Revenue Service. He signed a false tax return. This defendant, Your Honor, this was a man who chose what rules he would follow and what he wouldn't, what rules applied to him.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Havey. Mr. Nicole says, look, we can't have a rule, and I take it you've just agreed with this, that says multiple cash deposits over the course of a day that aggregate to some amount greater than $10,000 equals structuring. So we're all fine with that. Suppose you're in our position, and one of the three of us is writing an opinion that would affirm this conviction if we decide to do that. But suppose you are in that position, hypothetically. What more do you point to very concretely in this record? It's the money plus X, Y, and Z. What are X, Y, and Z here?
It's plus the three transactions, which you rightfully just questioned my opposing counsel about, with the customer, which these are the most stark examples of structuring, but he goes
but
to a
why
customer.
Do we infer backward from the fact that he did it three times, that he did it 25 other times?
It's not propensity evidence. It's direct evidence of his intent, Your Honor. And the notion that this man structured these three transactions, sort of these were three isolated transactions that he structured out of the blue, coming at the tail end of over 1,000 cash transactions over the course of the prior 18 months, which you point out, 1,148, the notion that he just structured these last three is, quite frankly, hard to swallow, and the jury didn't have to buy that.
But is it the number of the other transactions? Because Judge Rovner's example suggests that some kinds of small businesses, you know, the classic ones, dry cleaners, gas stations, some restaurants, you know, deal with a lot of cash, and
right.
People don't like having lots of cash sitting around.
But Judge, that I just point that out. That's one piece. There
all
is
right,
more.
So one thing you're saying is that we're supposed to take the evidence of the three as intent evidence that applies to the 25. What else?
Well, he was interviewed during the investigation. And this particular defendant admitted to federal agents that he knew that conducting a transaction in excess of $10,000 could cause the government to inquire into the nature of that transaction.
You know, it's legal for people. In fact, there's a whole, subspecialty in the law of lawyers who spend all of their time trying to help clients legitimately minimize their tax liability, legitimately, if you will, put together, I don't want to use the word structure, transactions in a way that will be favorable to them. And that's normally fine. I mean, occasionally things will come close to the line, but normally that's fine. So why would his simple awareness of the fact that cash transactions in excess of $10,000 attract unwanted attention be a culpable fact?
That's a fair question, Your Honor. In and of itself, standing alone, it is not, but there is more. That's one more point. In addition to that, he admitted to agents that he used members of his own family to cash checks in ways to keep the amounts under $10,000. Now, if this man is going to use his own family to control how much cash he's withdrawing from the bank, it's not a stretch for the jury to infer that he's also using his family to control how much cash he's depositing, Your Honor. And so all these things in isolation may not mean much, but when it starts to add up here, a reasonable jury could conclude, as this jury did, that all these $10,000, sub-$10,000 transactions, 1,145 out of 1,148, weren't under $10,000 by accident or by pure chance.
So your theory is basically the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. I mean, we have cases that say, you know, one little piece of evidence here, another there might not be enough, but when put together, a picture begins to emerge. That has to be what you're arguing.
Yes, Your Honor. And also, you know, I don't want to fall back on the standard of review because I think this case can be affirmed under any standard. But keep in mind, we're talking about manifest miscarriage of justice, which is the highest standard under the law here.
You know, we do want to talk, I suppose, about whether the district court abused its discretion in excluding evidence that the bank filed the CTRs because, you know, as we've noted, I guess, already, the structuring law is unlike many criminal statutes where knowledge of the law is presumed. And, the fact is that during your investigation, we learned that he said he did know about the requirements. But he also says he wasn't trying to evade them. He was so phenomenally unsuccessful in his attempts and his efforts, doesn't that kind of raise a little bit of a doubt in one's mind that his efforts were deliberate, and why wouldn't the court allow the evidence?
Well, the reason why judges is the stated reason that Judge Corr gave, which was that it was plainly irrelevant.
It was plainly?
Irrelevant, Your Honor.
That
the evidence was clearly irrelevant. It didn't prove anything. This defendant offered these CTRs, the fact that the bank filed CTRs, and the argument he's making here is that they somehow establish his state of mind. That if the bank filed CTRs, that's some proof that I didn't intend to evade them. That is a false argument, and that's the kind of argument, Your Honor, that leads to jury nullification. And when, in fact, the bank's filing of CTRs cannot establish the defendant's state of mind, if anything, or I should say the only thing it establishes is what the bank was thinking. Is that
did the bank have to file?
The bank was required by law to file them, Your Honor. And
is there any evidence that he knew the bank was filing?
No, and that I think may have made a difference, Judge. If he had proffered some evidence that said, I knew the bank was filing CTRs, therefore, how can you say
I guess to file them even if there are multiple transactions that he adds them up to the money?
Yes, sir. The bank is required to aggregate that day's...
For one day.
For one day.
Now, there you get to the one. Most people don't know that.
Most people don't know that, and probably most lawyers don't know that, Judge.
Yes, I know.
And this, I would submit, is the reason why this defendant was running around to different branches that day. And
but I still don't understand how we can call that irrelevant to the issue of his knowledge and intent.
Because, Your Honor, as Judge Wood pointed out, there is nothing in the record, and the defendant proffered nothing to lay any sort of foundation that he knew the bank was doing that. And I think without that, there is no fair inference that you can draw from the bank's filing of CTRs that he somehow, therefore, didn't intend to evade the fine.
No, but then we go back to the fact, I think, that the structuring law is very different from most criminal statutes. Because it's the government's burden to show he knew about the requirement and acted to evade it.
Well, Judge, I think we did carry our burden in establishing that, not only by his own statements, but by his acts of what he did here. And the fact that the bank did what it was supposed to do under the law, I'm not sure how that helps him. And if I could just add one more thing, Judge, and this goes, we also made the argument that if the judge did make an error, it was a harmless error. The defendant's own attorney argued to the jury that he didn't know about the CTR requirement. A bit of an inconsistent position, but he was arguing that. So I guess I'm not understanding how this evidence could have helped him. And the judge saw that, and he made that ruling. There was no doubt in his mind, Your Honor. And I think when we're looking under an abuse of discretion standard, which is whether reasonable people can disagree, that requires the court to uphold the decision of the district court. And I think that's the posture we're in here, Your Honor.
What about the letter from Mr. Livensparker? You argued to the jury that his request for the letter was evidence that he was trying to conceal his ownership interest in the house. And if the jury believed that that was a ground for conviction, how is that? Can that error be harmless under our case law?
We didn't argue that the defendant sought that letter. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Can you rephrase the question? We didn't. I don't think we argued it the way Your Honor just put it in that question.
The government suggested that he could be found guilty of concealment based on an action he took after the bankruptcy was completed.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. That's their argument. That's what they're saying. What we argued to the jury was that the defendant tried to obstruct his prosecution by seeking that letter, not that that was evidence of concealing. Now, I admit...
You certainly argued that to the court in the jury
correct.
Instruction.
I argued that, and that was mistaken, Judge, and we acknowledged that in the brief. We should have said... it was evidence of concealment, not that it was an act of concealment. The instructions that were given to the jury at the end of the day, Judge, were correct. The arguments that were made to the jury were permissible. They were not impermissible. This was a blip on the screen, Your Honor, that it was nothing the jury ever heard. And the judge made the correct ruling, perhaps for the wrong reasons, perhaps for an argument that I made it was wrong, but it was the correct ruling. And that argument that was made to the judge was not repeated before the jury. If there are no further questions, we would respectfully request that the court affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Nicol, we asked you so many questions that we're going to give you 2 minutes back.
Your Honor, Mr. Van Allen, the government was required to prove both that Mr. Van Allen had the intent to evade the CTR filing requirements and that he engaged in acts of structuring. Now, the other transactions may be relevant to Mr. Van Allen's intent, but the government had to prove actus reus. And under Davenport, this court clearly said that the anti-structuring statutes do not prohibit the making of a deposit. It prohibits the structuring of a transaction. And we believe that they didn't present evidence that a transaction was structured. They only presented evidence that deposits were made. Indeed, Your Honor, while Mr. Van Allen did make large volumes of deposits on many days, the same pattern of deposits into the Archer account existed on days where his deposits exceeded $10,000 as on days where the deposits did not exceed $10,000. On 79 days, Mr. Van Allen deposited less than $10,000, but through multiple deposits. As to the knowledge of the CTR requirements, the government had to show that he both knew the requirements and that he acted to evade them. The fact that his course of action necessarily...
He had known it. Pardon? He wouldn't have known about all the aggregate.
Your Honor, we believe that the fact that his actions necessarily resulted in the filing of CTRs sheds light on his knowledge.
Presume he knew.
Well, it sheds light on his knowledge. Either he knew it and didn't intend to evade it, or he did not know the requirements. And finally, as to our fifth argument about his discussions with Bridgeview Bank, Your Honor, the government sought and received an instruction that said concealment can occur after the bankruptcy. They introduced evidence.
They said after it began, though. There's an ambiguity there in the pattern instruction. Didn't say after it was completed.
I understand, Your Honor. And to that, Mr. Van Allen objected and said, we don't think there's any evidence of concealment after the bankruptcy. The government argued that the conversation with Bridgeview Bank was that concealment, and the judge accepted that. And then in closing arguments, in their rebuttal, they list all the things they thought he did to conceal the property, and then they close it off by saying, and he went to Bridgeview Bank and he attempted to obstruct justice and uncharged.
Which is a different thing, actually. But anyway, yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor. We ask that this court overturn Mr. Van Allen's conviction.
Well, you were court appointed, Ms. Nicole, and we really want to thank you and your firm, Jenner and Bott, for the help that you have given us today. It's very much appreciated.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And we, as always, thank the government as well, because we're happy you're around. Okay.